the death toll continues to rise after Libyan floods.
He said when the dam burst, his extended family were sleeping. No one was ready, he says.
Plus, Morocco's residents say the recent earthquake has shown the resilience and spirit of its people.
After helping to bury 22 of his relatives, Moulay Ibrahim resident Abdelhamid Awzal joined efforts to collect for those in need.
And North Korea's Kim Jong-un tells Russian President Vladimir Putin he supports Russia's war against Western imperialism.
We have constantly expressed our full and unconditional support.
Today is Thursday, September 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Bodies washed ashore in eastern Libya on Wednesday, raising the death toll from a storm that swept whole neighborhoods out to sea. Reuters reporter Olivia Zolino has more.
Rescue workers in Libya on Wednesday kept up desperate searches for survivors after a powerful storm tore through the country, bursting dams and washing whole neighborhoods out to sea. Thousands have been confirmed dead, with many thousands more still missing. In the hard-hit eastern city of Derna, soldiers were seen recovering bodies from the sea. Scores more lay out in the streets, covered in blankets, as people search for missing relatives. Among those searching is Mustafa Salem. He said when the dam burst, his extended family were sleeping. No one was ready, he says. We lost 30 people so far, 30 members of the same family. We haven't found anyone. Humanitarian aid is starting to arrive. This shipment is from Qatar. It's desperately needed for the estimated tens of thousands that have been displaced. Eight convoys and trucks carrying bulldozers were spotted by Reuters Wednesday. But rescue operations are complicated by deep political fractures in the country. There's an internationally recognized government of national unity in the West, and a parallel administration that operates in the East, including Derna. Speaking to Reuters by phone, one official from the administration that runs eastern Libya said, "The country did not have the experience to deal with the aftermath of such a disaster."
That was Reuters' Olivia Zolino. The damage caused by the most powerful earthquake to hit Morocco in over a century has been enormous, but residents say it has also shown the resilience and spirit of the people. Emmanuel Mojudibai visited one of the affected villages and has this story narrated by Arazuma Kampore.
The town of Moulay Ibrahim is near the epicenter of the earthquake that struck Morocco on September the 8th. This explains not only the extent of the damage recorded here, but also the large influx of people from other villages and towns who have come to help with rescue efforts.
I saw how many people have nothing left, nothing to eat, nothing to sleep on, nothing to live on. No one can remain indifferent. I really like all the people like me who live in Marrakech, because I know there are a lot of them. I'd like us to look after a few people, not just now. I'd like us to look after them now and keep in touch with them, and over time make contact. I'd love if people could come here and help out, and we all help each other out.
After helping to bury 22 of his relatives, Moulay Ibrahim resident Abdelhamid Awzal joined efforts to collect for those in need.
We are trying to put together everything we have received from citizens and residents of other villages. We are trying to gather everything here in the headquarters of this association, and we have organized the commissions to share with them afterwards. There are families in several surrounding areas here, so we are still at work.
Bader Manaouche, a primary school teacher who taught students in the High Atlas Mountains in Morocco, based in a village near the city of Asila, echoes the sentiments of those on the ground about how civilians come together in this time of crisis.
Many videos of people, they don't have nothing, but they give in. And this is known about Moroccan people. Moroccan people are ready, and you find them there whenever it's about like cooperation, solidarity, cohesion. Every time someone or some parts in Morocco needs something, they are all together. It's like a body.
The earthquake heavily hit the High Atlas Mountains, killing nearly 3,000 people and injuring over 5,000, according to official accounts. The earthquake is the country's deadliest since 1960. For Emmanuel Modjidibai in Moulay Ibrahim, Morocco, Orzuma Compaoré, VOA News.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un told Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday that he supports Russia's sacred war against Western imperialism. As Kim made a rare trip overseas to Russia's east for a meeting that is being closely watched by Washington and allies over concerns of a potential arms deal, Reuters' Edward Barron reports.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un expressed his support for what he called Moscow's sacred fight against Western imperialism as he met Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday. The pair exchanged a long handshake and warm greetings outside the Vostochny Cosmodrome, Russia's most modern space rocket launch facility located in the country's east. At the opening of their meeting, Kim spoke of his country's unwavering position to further develop its friendship and ties with Moscow.
Russia is now in the sacred fight against hegemonic forces to protect its sovereignty and security interests. We have constantly expressed our full and unconditional support for all the decisions taken by the president and Russian leadership. And I want to assure you that we will always be together with Russia in the fight against imperialism.
Putin showed Kim around the Cosmodrome, including the building where Russia's latest space booster is assembled. Earlier, when asked by reporters if Russia would help Kim build satellites, Putin said, quote, "That's why we came here." North Korea failed twice to launch reconnaissance satellites in the past 4 months, but the US has warned that an arms trade could be on the table. Kim's delegation includes top defense industry and military officials, a sign analysts say suggests an agenda heavy on defense industry cooperation. Washington and allies are concerned that Pyongyang will supply weapons to Moscow to aid its invasion in Ukraine, though both countries have denied such intentions. Meanwhile, just an hour before the highly anticipated meeting, North Korea launched 2 short-range ballistic missiles, according to South Korean and Japanese authorities. Analysts say it was the first launch by the North while Kim was abroad, and it could imply that Pyongyang is adopting an increasing level of delegation and more refined control systems for its nuclear and missile programs.
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, has launched a plan to assist at least 10 million Sudanese farmers, herders, and fishermen. The plan aims to address the threat of food insecurity in the country, which has been exacerbated by a 5-month-old armed conflict. Mohammed Youssef reports.
The Food and Agriculture Organization's 12-month program aims to improve the livelihoods of Sudanese farmers, herders, and fisher communities impacted by the ongoing war. The FAO will add to recent seed distribution efforts to enhance food production, with the hope of feeding 13 to 19 million people in coming months. Abdul Hakim El-Wair is the FAO regional representative for the Near East and North Africa. He says that the Emergency Livelihood Response Plan is designed to combat hunger and poverty in Sudan.
The ELRP aims to mitigate the impact of the recent conflict on vulnerable people, address their immediate needs, and enhance their ability to recover and strengthen their resilience, besides achieving food security at its minimum level for the overall population. Agriculture remains a lifeline in Sudan.
Sudan plunged into conflict in April, sparked by a power struggle between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces. The conflict has killed thousands of people, displaced millions, and prompted millions more to seek refuge in neighboring countries in search of food, medicine, and shelter. The FAO program intends to support farmers, herders, and fishers across 17 states in the country. Mohamed Abdulrahman, a farmer in Sudan's Upper Nile state, expressed optimism about the assistance.
I think this will help and will help us and will make others be encouraged to look and run after such kind of help and organize themselves in the first place. But I think the condition is demanding, is needed seriously. The Sudanese people need help from the international community, because really they lose their government.
Aid agencies say during Sudan's dry season, which runs from November to May, Farmers reliant on rainfall face food shortages, while livestock owners are faced with water and pasture shortages. Leading to threatened livelihoods. According to the Integrated Food Security Phase projections published last month, more than 20.3 million Sudanese are food insecure, with 6 million suffering from emergency levels of acute hunger. Abdulrahman says that Sudanese farmers require more than just seeds to produce food.
But I don't think that's enough, because the farmers need more than the seeds. They need money to make the preparations. They need money to go on the other agricultural activities.
The FAO said that much of the support for the vulnerable farming and herding households will be delivered through cash assistance and livelihood input packages, including seeds and agricultural, animal and fishing tools. El-Wair says the successful execution of their plan could prevent a humanitarian crisis and famine in Sudan.
FAO does not supply food directly to individuals, but supply seeds and agriculture inputs to farmers who are actually food producers to thousands of people. So if we reach out to 1.5 million farmers in Sudan in 14 states, we are literally providing food supplies, mainly vegetables and fruits and seeds like corn and wheat, for the large population of Sudan by the next harvest season, which will mitigate the situation and the crisis to a large extent.
The agriculture agency said it needs $123 million to achieve its goals, with the program expected to end in August 2024. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Russian officials said Wednesday a Ukrainian missile attack hit a shipyard in Russia-annexed Crimea. The Moscow-appointed governor of the port city of Sevastopol said 24 people were injured in the attack. Tom West, the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan, said on Tuesday that the Taliban's successful offensive against the Islamic State branch in Afghanistan has significantly degraded its capability and steadily decreased large-scale attacks against civilians. The White House on Wednesday defended a U.S.-Iran prisoner swap deal that has drawn criticism from Republicans, saying Iran gets no U.S. sanctions relief from the deal. Five U.S. citizens detained by Iran would be allowed to leave in exchange for the transfer of $6 billion in unfrozen funds and the release of five Iranians being held in the U.S. This is VOA News. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations on Wednesday, called on Moscow to immediately release American journalist Evan Gershkovich.
It has been nearly 6 months since Evan was arrested. To that end, Evan's parents have delivered a petition to the United Nations, a petition that calls on this institution to make clear that Evan Gershkovich has been arbitrarily detained and to push for his immediate release. We urge all member states to join this call for Evan's release and the release of all those who have been wrongfully detained.
The United States says Russia is using the Wall Street Journal reporter to conduct hostage diplomacy at a time when Moscow's war in Ukraine has plunged relations with Washington to their lowest point in more than 60 years.
I cannot imagine the pain that you are experiencing seeing your son, your brother, locked up for simply doing his job, for reporting the truth. No family should have to watch their loved one being used as a political pawn. And that's exactly what President Putin is doing. Russia's actions are beyond cruel, and they are a violation of international law.
Gershkovich has been detained in Russia since March 29th on espionage charges that he and the Wall Street Journal deny. Nicaragua's army chief has accused the media of trying to overthrow the government. The country's journalists, however, say such false comments only add to the country's repressive environment. For Donaldo Hernandez in Costa Rica, Veronica Villafañe has the story for VOA News.
Como han pretendido The head of Nicaragua's armed forces this month accused journalists of being information mercenaries intent on overthrowing President Daniel Ortega's government.
We say to these freeloaders and mercenaries of information financed by foreign interests that their lies and slander will never divide us.
At an event this month marking the 44th anniversary of the country's armed forces, Commander-in-Chief Julio César Avilés claimed reporters were trying to get the military to depose the president.
They call for more attacks against the institution to provoke a reaction from us, to stage a coup against the legitimately constituted government. Faced with these intentions, our response is resolute and clear. We will never do it.
The army chief didn't name specific media outlets, but the remarks came a few days after the news website Confidencial published a report on the leadership of the armed forces, including Avilés. The report said military leaders had submitted to Ortega's will, and some were complicit in repressing protests in 2018. Avilés himself came under U.S. sanctions in 2020 for his role in that action. He later dismissed the sanctions as an attempt to discredit the army. Elmer Rivas is a journalist at Confidencial.
Why does he attack journalists? Because they have documented cases of extrajudicial execution in rural areas, because journalists have revealed the complicity of the army with paramilitary groups whom it did not disarm, and also about how they have enriched themselves and how the dictatorship has rewarded their loyalty.
Media organizations rejected claims that they are trying to overturn the government and said such remarks add to an already hostile environment. Independent media are enduring a nightmare of censorship, intimidation, and threats, says media watchdog Reporters Without Borders, which ranks the country poorly on its global index. José Cardoza of the Independent Journalists of Nicaragua.
The army chief's hate speech shows that those in power continue to be uncomfortable with our work as journalists. We journalists have never advocated for a coup against the regime. We have simply done our job to inform.
In recent months, dozens of reporters have fled Nicaragua, fearing persecution, watchdogs say. But even after they're forced into exile, they still try to provide independent news coverage. For Donaldo Hernandez in Costa Rica, Veronica Villafañe, VOA News.
In Indian cities, most electric vehicles seen on the roads are not cars, but 3- and 2-wheeled vehicles that deliver goods and ferry passengers in cities. Anjana Pasricha reports on how the exponential growth in these electric vehicles in New Delhi and surrounding towns could contribute to cleaning up the air in one of the world's most polluted cities.
The call by 3-wheel electric rickshaw drivers to passengers as they alight from metro stations has become a familiar sound in the Indian capital and towns around it. Electric rickshaw owner Abdul Alam says his vehicle is much better than a gasoline one because it is cheaper to run and does not create pollution. He says once charged, the battery lasts for 80 to 100 kilometers. Another electric rickshaw owner, Adir Bia, agrees, saying he buys no gasoline and spends only about $25 a month to charge the battery, giving him a good income. The shared rides that cost as little as 8 cents have made these e-vehicles popular. Moshimi Mohanty is head of electric vehicle technology with the Center for Science and Environment in New Delhi.
The market is basically pushing it. And it's taking care of last mile mobility. It's a little bit like decarbonizing trips. These small trips from the metro to home or the market, from the bus stop to office.
The 3- and 2-wheelers are driving India's transition to electric mobility. They make up about 90% of electric vehicles in the country. Federal and state government subsidies for manufacturers, combined with high petrol costs, are fueling sales. 3-wheel electric vehicles are also playing a key role as a booming e-commerce market adds road trips. This startup uses electric vehicles to make about 20,000 deliveries a day, in and around Delhi. Owner Pratik Rao.
Sustainability is something which is very close to our heart. We are all new age people. We are a very new age, young and aggressive team. We think that somewhere or the other, if we are contributing to the ecosystem back, then why not? So we adopted EV as the core technology.
The switch is important for a city where the millions of vehicles that clog its roads spew almost half the emissions that dirty its air. Again, Mohanty.
It'll help a whole lot. Because look at the numbers that we are trying to transition. So if you are converting, say, 10% or 20% or 30% of these vehicles into electric, it basically means there is a gap there. There's zero emission from there.
But challenges remain, says Rao.
Charging infrastructure is the pain point at the moment. If we want to achieve a faster adoption of EVs across India, we need to improve the space.
The bigger challenge in a country where coal is still king for power generation will be to clean up the electricity that charges these vehicles as their numbers increase. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. This is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is determined to deepen bilateral engagement with the People's Republic of China, including in ways that advance U.S. commercial and strategic interests. Toward that end, Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo recently met in Beijing and Shanghai with several high-level PRC officials, including her direct counterpart, PRC Minister of Commerce Wang Wentao. Secretary Raimondo called the meetings productive, candid, and constructive.
I was able to explain our policies and our approach to China, and I heard from my Chinese counterparts. I was able to explain clearly that we will protect what we must and promote what we can. And that means national security is non-negotiable. But despite that, there's plenty of business we can do.
Business relationships between the United States and the PRC are to be encouraged, said Secretary Raimondo, but so is advocating for U.S. business and workers when the playing field is unfair.
I raised issues like subsidies, raids on U.S. firms, and intellectual property theft. Businesses need a predictable regulatory environment. We are not returning to the days when we had dialogue for dialogue's sake, but shutting down communication and decoupling services is neither in our economic or national security goals.
Secretary Raimondo said she and PRC Minister Wang created new channels of communication that will allow us to raise and ideally resolve issues. The first is a consultation mechanism involving U.S. and PRC government officials and private sector representatives to seek solutions on trade and investment issues. The second channel is an export control enforcement information exchange, a platform to reduce misunderstandings over U.S. national security policies. That's not a working group on export controls to seek concessions, said Secretary Raimondo, but it is an opportunity to share information and increase transparency. Additionally, the two countries will convene subject matter experts from both sides to hold technical discussions on how to protect trade secrets and international property, and they agreed to communicate regularly at the secretary and minister levels and to meet in person at least once annually. The biggest achievement of her visit to China, said Secretary Raimondo, was just to start regular communication. You can't solve any problems without first communicating, she declared. And now we have to launch these different mechanisms, then see what problems we might be able to solve.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.